Good day, and welcome to SNC-Lavalin's first quarter 2015 earnings conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Denis Jasmin, Vice President of Investor Relations. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to SNC-Lavalin's 2015 first quarter earnings conference call. With us today are Robert Card, President and Chief Executive Officer, and Alain-Pierre Renaud, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. We also have with us today Neil Bruce, our newly appointed Chief Operating Officer. Our earnings announcement was released this morning, and we have posted a slide presentation on our website, which we will refer to during our call. Before we begin, I would like to ask everyone to limit themselves to two or three questions to ensure that all analysts have an opportunity to participate. You are welcome to return to the queue for any follow-up questions. I would also like to remind you that, as detailed on slide three, certain statements or comments made during today's call and slide presentation may be forward-looking. Such statements or comments represent management's best judgment and expectation as of today's date, are subject to certain risks, uncertainties, and assumptions, which are described in our financial documents and cannot be guaranteed. I would now like to turn the conference over to Robert Card.
Merci, Denis, and thank you all for joining us today. Our first quarter results exceeded our plan and have begun to reflect the hard work and contributions of our employees in building our growth platform. While we are not yet at our long-term targeted EBITDA to revenue ratio of 6% to 8%, our encouraging results demonstrate the best project delivery stability since March 2012. We're optimistic about the year, but given the volatility that persists in the macro environment, we're maintaining our outlook for 2015 of adjusted EPS from E&C in the range of $1.30 to $1.60. Our global capabilities and delivery model give us important scale and an excellent competitive position in our industry. This is particularly apparent in our most recent wins. We are a member of the team that the Government of Canada selected as the preferred bidder for the new bridge for the St. Lawrence, which has also been referred to as the Champlain Bridge Replacement. This means we will finance, design, build, operate, and maintain the bridge. Additionally, we won two sustaining capital contracts from a major oil company in the Middle East with an anticipated combined value of over $500 million. With an already strong backlog, we're optimistic about our ability to feed in quality projects like these and to compete for projects like the Eglinton Crosslink Transit solution. We also recently announced important organizational changes, promoting Neil Bruce to the new position of Chief Operating Officer. We've made good progress in project delivery and business development by focusing on people, processes, and systems. As part of our plan to accelerate our drive to continue to improve operational execution, we decided to create the COO position, and we're thrilled to have Neil in that role. It should also enable me to spend additional time pursuing resolution of our important legal matters, which I will discuss later. I'd like now to pass the call over to Neil Bruce, who will provide more perspective on our operational thinking. Neil?
Thank you, Bob. These are exciting times for the company, and I'm pleased to be here today to outline to our shareholders how we will drive operational excellence for the future success of the company. The new position of COO was created with a goal to ensure that we perform consistently across our sectors and geographies with a client-focused organization. I want us to be known for our people, our assurances of execution, and be at the top of our clients' preferred list of partners. Our focus will be to accelerate our operational excellence, and there are immediate benefits to this new structure. Centralized management of our operations. Everything centers around executing work for our clients with our functional support designed accordingly. The focus on the execution end of our business means that project delivery is the primary objective for all our operating teams. Enables our business to better align with our markets. The four sectors are how our customers see us, and this builds cross-selling opportunities. Creates opportunities to take best practice from each sector and replicate it across our organization. The process for proposal reviews and approvals is strengthened further, helping us achieve higher margins and avoid uncommercial outcomes. We will also gain stronger cost controls. Allows us to share solutions and best practices to make improvements, and it builds cross-selling opportunities across markets and geographies. In short, the new structure will strengthen our delivery, and winning of business across our four key markets, power, infrastructure, oil and gas, and mining. When combined with our financing and operations and maintenance capabilities, we have a strong competitive advantage against our peers. As you will have seen from the announcement, as part of combining our operational management, we also revised our approach to our global operations. Over the past few years, the global operations framework has helped us expand geographically and increase our presence in key markets to build on our strong Canadian business. Following this growth and the integration of Kentz, we are now at a stage where we are truly an international operator. For this reason, we are ensuring that our global management is embedded into our operations. We have seasoned executives already in place in each of our sectors. Sandy Taylor in power, Ian Edwards in infrastructure, Jose Suarez in mining, and Chris Brown in oil and gas. As part of our global framework, each of these leaders will have stewardship for one of our regions determined by their experience and their business sector's presence regionally. By focusing on operational excellence, we will see improvements in both performance and business winning through the financial cycle and over the longer term. We believe this is integral in helping us deliver efficiently. Of all our operational elements, safety, security, and ethics remains our most important. Excellence in these areas will mean that we are well organized and efficient in our delivery, which in turn will be fundamental in reaching our goals. I look forward to updating you all on our progress. I, with my colleagues, will be available at the end of the call for any questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil. We're confident that our organizational improvements will help differentiate SNC-Lavalin as we continue to move towards becoming a global Tier 1 engineering and construction firm. I want to thank Hisham Mahmood and Christian Jacquet, who are moving on to other phases of their careers. They each tackled challenging parts of the business and created efficient structures and world-class teams to help prepare the groundwork for future success. I also want to take a moment to thank Rajan Goulet, our general counsel, who announced that he will retire from SNC-Lavalin this summer after a career of nearly 30 years with the company. He built an outstanding team and will continue to assist the company on specific litigation matters after retirement. Now let's talk about our ICI portfolio. In line with our five-year strategic plan announced in 2013, we are implementing our strategy of monetizing assets within our infrastructure concession investments portfolio. We've decided to accelerate the process for monetizing most of our remaining Canadian assets other than 407, with a possible completion date late this year or early next, and we are committing to launch the formal sale of 407 itself no later than the fourth quarter of this year and have retained a team of BMO and HSBC as advisors for that process. We continue to see strong demand for such high-quality long-term infrastructure assets and are being deliberate in our process in order to maximize shareholder value. As in the case of the new bridge for the St. Lawrence, our strategy is to remain an active asset investor, particularly in the development cycle, where synergies with our E&C business create competitive advantage and opportunities for significant value creation. As noted earlier, one of the benefits of our new organization will be enabling me to increase my focus on strategy and legacy liability issues. With regard to the latter, we are very pleased with the media recognition we received regarding the high quality of our ethics and compliance system. Some have used the words gold standard, and we would not dispute this. We've always been remaining willing to reach a reasonable and fair solution that promotes accountability while permitting us to continue to do business and protect the livelihood of our over 40,000 employees, our clients, our investors, other stakeholders, and the Canadian economy. We're strongly encouraged by the support expressed so far by many stakeholders toward that objective. The federal government proposed in its recent budget to introduce a new government-wide integrity regime for its procurement to ensure that it does business with ethical suppliers in Canada and abroad. The budget document says that the framework will also foster ethical business practices, ensure due process, and uphold the public trust. And we support these principles unequivocally. However, the focus of the new integrity framework is limited to procurement for the Government of Canada. This leaves Canadian companies with significant international businesses at risk in other jurisdictions unless Canada adopts policies which are consistent with its peers, such as the U.S. and U.K. These peer country policies incentivize the aggressive adoption of rigorous compliance programs and early and complete self-reporting while holding firms accountable for infractions, but protecting employees, communities, and other key stakeholders. Now, moving to our financial results. Earnings for the quarter were $104 million, or 68 cents per diluted share, as compared to $95 million, or 62 cents per diluted share in 2014. Our adjusted net income from ENC for the quarter was $57 million, or 38 cents per diluted share, compared to $32 million, or 20 cents per diluted share for last year. The increase is driven by a higher contribution from our key growth segments, including oil and gas and power, and an improvement in the mining and metallurgy segment. Bolstered by our successful Kent's acquisition, we expect oil and gas and power to continue to drive ENC net income improvements in 2015. ICI continued to perform well with net income of $37 million, or 24 cents per diluted share, compared to $64 million, or 42 cents per diluted share in Q1 2014. The variance was mainly due to the sale of AltaLink and Astoria last year, resulting in no net income benefit for 2015. This was partially offset by an increase in dividends received from Highway 407. Our cash position was $1.1 billion at quarter end, in line with March 2014, and we expect to remain in a comfortable position. We have a strong financial position and the financial flexibility necessary to fund operations while simultaneously taking advantage of current circumstances to buy back shares. We expect to be significantly more active in our share repurchase program, as permitted by law and subject to market conditions. Accordingly, we announced today that we intend to renew our NCIB, or Normal Course Issuer Bid, program at the beginning of June, subject to TSX approval, for up to 13.3 million common shares, which is the maximum buyback capability available under an NCIB. Moving now to our segment review. As I mentioned earlier, we had several positive wins in oil and gas, which underscore our confidence in this segment being a driver of 2015 revenues and future growth. Despite a challenged commodity price environment, we've been able to drive solid results in oil and gas. Importantly, we now have access to key oil and gas markets, especially those like the Middle East, that continue to focus on production in the current environment. We also benefit from our services breadth, including sustaining capital services, which extract more value from existing assets. In mining and metallurgy, end markets remain challenged, but we've had a number of positive conversations with customers who are positioning to be ready to go once the market starts to turn. To be clear, with many commodities at near-term lows, we believe the market will take time to fully recover. We're having relatively fewer discussions about capital pullback, so some positive signs are there. For power, we have a good project pipeline, and our new nuclear build opportunities continue to progress. However, we are keeping a watchful eye on timing issues in the award and notice to proceed of key work in T&D, thermal, and nuclear. Hydro is showing unexpected strength this year as existing projects progress well and new opportunities emerge. In infrastructure and construction, we have succeeded in stabilizing the situation in the quarter. We are particularly pleased with the St. Lawrence Bridge project, which reflects our ability to win competitive public sector contracts as well as our experience in bridge construction. Having committed considerable energy to revitalizing our project assessment and control procedures, we are well positioned to deliver fixed price projects on time and budget and look forward to leveraging these strengths to drive growth and performance in this segment. We continue to see a strong pipeline of new projects, particularly in Canada. Operation maintenance performance continues to be good, and we expect an overall improvement this year with important new wins and some P3 projects moving into the operational phase. In summary, while we expect an unfavorable macroeconomic environment, we are optimistic regarding our ability to compete and deliver for 2015 and beyond and to drive toward meeting our EBITDA margin target while becoming a global Tier 1 ENC firm. With that, I'll pass the call over to Len Pierre to discuss our results in more detail. Len Pierre?
Thank you, Bob. Good afternoon, everyone. I will start my presentation on slide 6. Revenues for the first quarter increased by 31%. To $2.3 billion compared to $1.7 billion for 2014. This increase includes incremental services and packages revenues from Cairns, in line with our goal of having a more cost-centric project delivery model, as well as an increase in the power segment, as we are no longer required to eliminate ENC revenue generated between the company and AutoLink. The gross margin amount for the quarter was $337 million compared to $357 million of the first quarter of 2014. ENC gross margin increased by $65 million, while the ICI gross margin decreased by $85. The ENC gross margin increase is mainly due to higher volume of activity in the oil and gas segments, power and mining, including for these two segments, favorable rate forecast on project nearing completion. I remind you that the 2014 ENC gross margin includes a net favorable impact of $35 million, mainly due to the reversal of a risk provision on a Libyan project. ICI's gross margin mainly decreased due to the sale of AutoLink. SG&A expense for the first quarter of 2015 totaled $207 million compared to $187 million for the first quarter of 2014, mainly due to the incremental SG&A expenses in connection with the Kemps acquisition. On a like-to-like basis, without Kemps, SG&A expenses decreased by about $20 million. As the fourth quarter of 2014 included Kemps, it was to compare first quarter 2014 with first quarter 2015. SG&A from ENC decreased by 6% in the first quarter 2015 compared to the first quarter 2014 from $212 million to $199 million. This decrease is mainly attributable to cost savings resulting from the company's initiatives to contain this cost. In the first quarter of 2015, we recorded approximately $500,000 of restructuring costs, principally related to our restructuring and right-sizing plan announced last November. The company is continuing its efforts to complete this plan, which is expected to result in approximately $45 million of after-tax charges over the next 11 months. We also recorded in the first quarter of 2015 $8 million of acquisition-related and integration costs, and $21 million of amortization of intangible assets, both in connection with the Kemps acquisition. The net financial expenses, which stood at $51 million in the first quarter of 2014, decreased by $84 million in 2015, consequently generating a net financial income of $33 million. Two factors drove this net financial income: the non-recourse debt reduction due to the sale of AutoLink, which triggered a decrease of $44 million in our net financial expense, and a net foreign exchange gain of $37 million, mainly related to intergroup loans used for repayments of recourse debt of Kemps in 2014. Lastly, on this slide, we see that our net income was $104 million for the period in 2015, compared to $95 million in the first quarter of 2014. Now, turning to slide 7. The slide shows the adjustments we made to get to the adjusted consolidated net income. In the first quarter of 2015, adjusted consolidated net income was $94 million compared to $95 in the first quarter of 2014. The adjusted net income from ENC was $55 million compared to an adjusted net income of $32 million in 2014. This increase of $25 million is mainly due to higher contribution from our oil and gas and power segments. The adjusted net income from ICI was $37 million in 2015 compared to $64 in 2014, mainly due to the sale of AutoLink in 2014, which is no longer contributing now. Slide 8 gives you more detail on our net financial income and expenses. As just explained, the main variance is due to the AutoLink net financial expenses and a net foreign exchange gain. Now, turning to slide 9. In the first quarter of 2015, we revised the composition of our reportable segments to reflect a change made to our internal reporting structures. We retrospectively reclassify the environment and water subsegment included in the previously resources, environment and water segment, known as AEW, to the infrastructures and construction subsegment. As Neil just explained, we recently announced certain organizational changes in order to further align our business structures with end markets. This reorganization resulted in certain changes in the way activities are regrouped and reportable segments are presented and analyzed. As such, the company's reportable segments are now mining and metallurgy, oil and gas, power, infrastructures, and ICI. Furthermore, As indicated in our December 2014 MD&A, corporate G&A expenses that are not directly related to project or segments are no longer allocated to the company's segment starting January 2015. Therefore, the company's segment EBIT no longer includes its corporate G&A expenses, which used to be allocated based on the gross margin of each of these segments. We believe that the use of such segment EBIT will improve the quality of the company's segment disclosure by providing information that is more comparable relating to their results from operations. Comparative figures have been restated accordingly. Slide 10 now. Slide 10 presents the segment EBIT. As you can see, the ICI segment EBIT for the first quarter of 2015 is contributing less, mainly due to the sale of AltaLink in 2014. All segments, except for the infrastructures and construction segments, are positively contributing to the first quarter 2015 EBIT. We can also see that the oil and gas segment is performing well, as Kent continue to meet all our objectives in terms of revenues, gross margin, EBIT, and net income accretion. Now, turning to slide 11. Revenue backlog totaled $11.6 billion at the end of March 2015. This is slightly lower than December 2014, but 39% higher than March 2014. The increase compared to March 2014 is due to the services and packages revenue backlog, which grew largely due to the addition of Kent's revenue backlog. The March 2015 revenue backlog does not yet include the project for the new bridge of the Saint Laurent corridor. This project will be added to the revenue backlog once signed and the financial close is completed. Slide 12 shows our financial position. Two variations are worth mentioning. First, cash and cash equivalent totaled $1.1 billion as at March 31, 2015, compared to $1.7 billion as at December 31, 2014. We will see the details of this variance on the next slide. Secondly, goodwill increased, mainly due to the strengthening of the U.S. dollars versus the Canadian dollar. Slide 13 summarizes the cash flow variation of this year's first quarter. The most significant variation was the cash outflow from income tax paid on the sale of AltaLink, about $240 million, and the net change in non-cash working capital items. Our working capital position remains strong, despite the net change in non-cash working capital items standing at minus $459 million. Two-thirds of this amount is due to an increase in contract in progress and a decrease in deferred revenues, a trend that we expect to be reversed within the rest of the year. Now, turning to slide 14. As Bob mentioned, we are maintaining our previously announced 2015 outlook for the adjusted EPS from ENC of $1.30 to $1.60. But we are increasing our reported IFRS EPS to reflect the one-time net foreign exchange gain recorded in the first quarter of $37 million. This concludes my part of the presentation. We can now open the lines for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, it is star 1 to ask a question. One moment for your first question, please. Your first question comes from the line of Sarah O'Brien of RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Question for Neil, I guess, about the oil and gas segment. We noticed there's a big fall off in the sales number quarter over quarter in that segment, and just wondered if you can comment on that in particular, and also on the bidding environment that you're seeing now in light of crude still being at a weak level.
So I take the second piece first. So in terms of the bidding environment, without a doubt, all of our customers are focused on costs. They certainly are looking at opportunities to drive costs down. Now we in our position, I think we are able to in most cases be able to provide a more cost efficient solution to them rather than getting driven down the line of talking purely about margins. The bidding environment is mixed. And again, it is very much aligned to what you would expect within the oil and gas market globally, which is the high cost producing areas are the areas where bidding is reduced. So things like the Canadian oil sands are certainly more challenged. But then places like the Middle East, where an awful lot of our work is actually brownfield and sustaining capital, as you saw certainly today in the presentation, we've won $1 billion worth of work alone within the Middle East. So it is a mix that is challenging, but there is also opportunities, I think, to increase the both the bids and the projects that we win and ultimately our backlog.
But Neil, just to be clear, this is Bob, Sarah. We're confident in our numbers for oil and gas for 2015. So Neil's talking about the macro environment. We're all in it, but things look good for us for 2015.
Yeah, okay. And ultimately, as we said, there's $500 million worth of new projects that are actually ramping up at the moment.
Okay, and just could you comment on the quarter-over-quarter decline? I think it was about 30%, so just wondering if there was anything particular in there.
No, sorry, that's mainly the, you know, they have large projects at Kent's, which we're recognizing revenue, but like Neil said, we're now ramping up with our $500 million project, which has been signed.
Okay. And then a question on the Champlain Bridge and the impact to the infrastructure group. Wondered maybe, NIPM, if you can comment on profitability outlook. You know, what does it take to get to a profitable EBIT within the infrastructure group? Is Champlain Bridge enough, or are there other elements that you need to see?
There is, Bob. I'll take that if that's all right. So Champlain Bridge is a big help. Again, we're bidding all of these projects to make money on them. So I want to make that really clear. There's no throwaways in here. What we said is Champlain plus should we be fortunate enough to prevail in Eglinton, which we feel pretty good about, sets us up pretty good for this year. There's a very strong pipeline in Canada alone, let alone other countries. So our model would suggest that, I think we mentioned this in the last call, that at this pace of work off of bad backlog and adding good backlog, that by 2017 we should be starting to hit good upside numbers. 2016 we should be in the black. 2017 we should be starting to hit normal industry margins. And so that's what we're shooting for.
But we can have that for Pont-Champlain. We are fully in line with our objective as disclosed in our MD&A.
Okay, that's helpful. Just a last question on guidance, the $1.32, $1.60. Q1 did see a positive project reforecast, which was nice to see. Just wondering if the $1.32, $1.60, do you include any other positive such reforecasts throughout the year?
Well, we have a basket of things that happen within those numbers, and I guess when we, just to go back to reinforce what we said, we're optimistic about the year in general, but given headwinds in the macroeconomic environment, we're reluctant to do an increase at this time. I don't know if Alain Pierre, if you want.
No, I fully agree with you. It's not the time to do so, considering our global environment we have to move in. What we observe is that all operations, as you can observe, during Q1 deliver in line with our objectives. We have a good perspective for our backlog through the different projects we just win at Pont-Champlain, but let's say oil and gas win two other projects in Middle East. So let's say all our indicators are on the green, and we have to deliver according to your expectation and to our expectation.
And Sarah, specifically your question, we do have a number of opportunities we've been talking about to add more to that with good news on projects like some that we had. So we'll certainly take all of those we can find.
Okay, and those would be in addition to your current guidance?
In many cases, that's true, not all of them.
Okay, thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Michael Tupholm of TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Good afternoon. Just wanted to clarify. I understand there was the favorable reforecast in power, but I wasn't sure if Alain Pierre mentioned any other favorable reforecasts in the quarter in mining or anywhere else.
No, we have, let's say, the what I mentioned is the normal way to run the business when projects are closed from terminations. We have a deep review and we analyze the risk one by one, and if it appears that we are on track, we release the contingency, so there is nothing exceptional. And this was a recurring way to manage a project for every E&C company, so you will find once again that in the quarter number 2, 3, and 4. I mentioned that just, let's say, in the sake to mention that in our portfolio of projects, mainly in mining and power, we have a substantial number of projects which are going now to the end, very close to termination. But let's say the backlog is renewed step by step, and as you have seen in our forecast, we intend to have a strong backlog at year end.
Yeah, we don't see the power reforecast as a special deal.
No.
That's normal operating.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Thanks. And then next question relates to the buyback that you announced today, and I guess I'm wondering, it's clear from your comments, Bob, that you expect to be much more active in using this buyback, but I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that and maybe provide a bit of color in terms of how comfortable you are, you know, how much your current cash balance you're comfortable directing toward that buyback, to what extent those purchases maybe in some way tie back to some of the ICI initiatives, divestiture initiatives you mentioned, and any color around timing, if this is sort of, you know, right now you're going to start, or if this is sort of later in the year. Anything on that front would be helpful. Thank you.
Well, I'll say a few things and turn it over to Lynn Pierre. So first, going back to front on timing, we expect this to be a continuous process. So it's not in and out. As you know, we haven't been able to buy back until a few days last quarter because of being in discussions or having privileged information. So we have to be on the same footing as every other investor when we do it. So we're trying to arrange this such that we can continue with the program in spite of that. We think we have a path through that. The buyback, you know, I would say, Denise, I can say it's conditional on value. So it's not buying back at any price. So we will have mechanisms in there to manage that. But we expect it to be a regular program, and we believe that we have the cash, and even if we had to go into our credit facility, it's a good deal. But when we look at anticipated cash infusions that we'll have during the process, we think we can do it without stressing our system. Lynn Pierre, you want to comment on that?
No. As Bob mentioned, we'll be in a continuum process in order to avoid the step and go, which are detrimental to you and to us. First point. Second point, we never disclose never the amount of cash we want to allocate nor the target of share price. But we consider that it's a good opportunity considering the market situation and our situation in the market. It illustrates the trust we have in the future of this company, and this buyback program will compromise the stabilization of our performance and the other step of our strategy as we disclose.
So maybe I'll just ask one follow-on to that. I mean, would it be reasonable to assume at the current prices and under the current circumstances that you would expect to fully execute this entire buyback?
I don't comment that.
Yeah,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
And just lastly, Bob, I was wondering if you can just elaborate a little bit more on this this initiative as it relates to monetizing your Canadian other ICIs, X407. So specifically, if you can just provide a bit more color, but also, as I understand it, a number of those are still in the construction process. So how do those fall into that initiative?
Again, I'll say a few things and let Alain Pierre jump in. So we've been mentioning in various meetings and these calls that we've been looking at these other assets for several years. We've just been busy on the big ones. And the team has recently come up with some ideas that we like about how to monetize even some that are in process. So I don't know we're ready to disclose exact mechanism yet, but Lem Pierre, you want to add anything?
No, exactly. In line with what you just explained, we try to take advantage of the very strong infrastructure market. So we would like to extract value from this portfolio of assets. Obviously, we have not the intention to abandon our P3 activities. It's one of our main golden cards, and we continue to play it. So we intend to extract value and to do that quite fast, and our expectation is to be capable to do that before the end of the year.
Let me make it clear, we don't need to do this from a cash or proceeds. It does help us with things like the buyback program, but we just see an opportunity emerging in front of us, and if we can dot all the I's and cross the T's, we want to take advantage of it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Bert Powell of BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Robert, you said Q1 exceeded your plan. Was that the cost reforecast, or what was specific in the results that exceeded what you thought you'd do in the quarter?
Let's say we mentioned that operations are in line with our expectations, so the excess versus our expectation is due to non-operating as a foreign exchange. It was an opportunity, and we take advantage of it. We also have, thanks to the Altalink sale, you remember, Altalink is now out of our balance sheet, so we have a lot of costs related to the non-recourse debt, which disappeared. On top of that, we fully reimburse all our line of credit we draw to organize this acquisition. So from a pure financial point of view and balance sheet structures, we are in a better shape, and the consequences on our P&L. Now, what we just said, that we deliver what is expected in terms of operation once again, and we'll continue to do so.
Okay, so I'm just trying to think about this in the context of the guidance. You've got $1.30 to $1.60. You had a $17 million dollar favorable reforecast in the quarter, and you said the quarter I interpret to be coming in better than you thought. So I'm trying to figure out to reconcile keeping the guidance, the favorable reforecast, and all that you said with respect to the balance sheet, and a quarter that you classify as exceeding your expectations. I'm just trying to.
You remember that in our explanation, we disclosed the fact that for the consolidated IFRS guidance, EPS, at consolidated level, we adjust them in order to take into account the foreign exchange gain we realized during Q1, which is frozen for the remaining of the year. So we take that into consideration. Now, for ENC, we built the guidance on the fact that we try to give guidance based on operations in order to make the illustration what is our efficacy in managing this company, and we exclude this type of gain.
Okay. Maybe I'll move on to the next question. Just with respect to other ICI, can you give us an update? Are you in a position now to put your Ambitovi interest to Sumitomo?
So Ambitovi, as Sherrod announced, we have achieved the 90% production threshold, so we're really thrilled about that. We have a handful of other criteria that have to be met to fully achieve our objective. We're optimistic about that at this point, but we're not celebrating just yet. So, but we're optimistic and watching it carefully.
So, Bob, would that fall into the camp of one of the things you hope to get monetized by the end of the year?
Oh, we're always hoping to, but that's one that is not in our guidance at this point in time.
Okay. And if I could just sneak one last one in, just in terms of the oil and gas, $760 million in the quarter, I think back, if memory serves, with Kent, it was kind of a 40-60 first half, second half seasonality to that business. Is that the right way to think of it? In other words, 760 in the first quarter would kind of imply still well over $3 billion of revenue in the oil and gas business for the year. Am I thinking about that correctly?
It's Neil. Generally, there is a seasonality in the business. However, the one thing that we do need to watch is the fact that we have really high activity on the LNG projects in Australia, which clearly is not seasonal. That is something that's running all the way through. So I wouldn't rely totally on Kent's historical seasonality within the results. I think it will be more predictable through the quarters of this year.
Okay. Maybe we can add that also we have the legacy oil and gas, which is, let's say, suffering from, a difficult environment in West Canada, which also create trouble if you want to analyze the historical cycle of this activity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the year, I mean, we've been very open about MEG Energy's decision to pull back and postpone a contract there, and that effectively was certainly was forecast to be within the first quarter, and that's certainly not there within that period. And there was also one in Houston. So ultimately, the other parts of the business, which is more asset support, brownfield, has compensated overall for that. So the mix is changing slightly.
Okay, that's very helpful, Neil. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Anthony Zucha of Scotiabank. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Could we expect decreases in the SG&A costs, especially in the mining and the metallurgy, to result in more of a solid improvement in operating margins going forward?
Well, you should definitely expect the SG&A costs to continue to improve. So as we've said before, that'll be a continuous basis. I don't know if, Len Pierre, you want to address that in general or Neil specifically?
Yeah, I mean, we do have a plan to improve within mining around some of our geographies. So as we continue to simplify the organization and bring our sectors within certain geographies, and from a mining perspective, it's very much around Australia and South Africa, there are opportunities there for us to pull together the support services and the G&A part of the SG&A, and for us to be able to improve that in the next three quarters, and we're certainly looking to do that.
Okay, good. And excluding the favorable reforecast, can you give us a bit more color on the power segment margins, given Altalix's inter-segment revenues are not being included?
Well, I think, you know, the power market continues to be a strong market. As we said before, we have a lot of work to do to replace the AltaLink volume. It was fairly low margin, so we need less volume to replace the margin, and I'm really happy with what the team are up to there. The concern, as I mentioned in my discussion, is, or my talk, is that, you know, we're having some challenge getting final authorization from clients. And so that, to me, that's the biggest worry for the year, is whether we get further delays in final authorizations, because we still have a number of projects that we've been selected on that haven't got full notice to proceed yet. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I think it's a fairly robust market with lots of upside opportunities. So that's another reason why we're kind of holding firm on the guidance, is to see what happens with that timing.
Okay, and one last question, Bob. Could you give us some perspectives on your global prospects and where you see the markets being the most promising? You mentioned Canada is pretty promising. Could you also give us some examples?
On the company as a whole or just power?
No, on the company as a whole.
Company as a whole, okay. Well, and Neil, I invite you to jump in too as well. So Middle East is still very strong, and oil and gas, well, across the board for everything there. But oil and gas is our strongest play, and we see lots of big mining and metallurgy projects in the end decision phase there, so that's quite a promising area. Canada is promising in power, but especially in infrastructure. There's just a long pipeline of projects. So, you know, we've been talking about $10 billion plus, and even though we're working off that pipeline, it still stays at $10 billion plus. And so we're quite comfortable with what that looks like. You know, we want to stretch beyond Canada and power and infrastructure. Those are key goals we have. And as we increase our footprint and part of the operational objective we had with the CEO job, as Neil talked about, is helping revise our sponsorship of our international locations to try to deploy more of our end markets across greater geography spread. So, I don't know, Neil, you want to add anything to that?
I think the Middle East or the Gulf States, the wider UAE, including and Saudi Arabia, is certainly a great market for all four sectors, as you said. But then as you go down sector by sector, then that changes slightly. So certainly for an infrastructure perspective, Canada is proving to be pretty strong with more prospects there. And in mining, we certainly see opportunities starting to emerge in Latin America and some of the other areas in terms of the sulfuric acid work and expansions in the Middle East also. And we've got the ongoing continued expansion of our activities in Australia. So not necessarily brand new contract awards, but in terms of expanding our offering to clients and expanding our activities, that continues to expand as we go along.
We have a lot of pent-up commitments in mining that if the market breaks, we should be prepared to move out fairly quickly.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Yuri Lynk of Canaccord Genuity. Please go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon. Bob, now that Neil's going to help you out on the operations side, you'll have more time on strategy. You know, you often talk about S&C being a tier one, striving to be a tier one E&C firm. What type of E&C firm is it going to be, Bob? I mean, most of the top players have either a proprietary technology that gives them an advantage, or they go technology agnostic and they have extremely strong execution capabilities. So how do you see S&C fitting into a field of competitors that's kind of bifurcated in that sense?
Well, I think all of the above. I mean, I think you have to have, you know, blue chip execution capability to survive. We're investing a lot in that. That's another key part of Neil's role, is to keep building on our capability there. And I think we've done some great things with our systems and training and whatnot. So that's the bedrock of what we do. But we also do have technology and CANDU as an example, where we have a proprietary technology edge, and I think it's working well for us. Valeris is another case where, you know, it's not so much proprietary, but we have a great position there. You know, it'd be nice to have more robust market in their space right now, but there's still a lot of really interesting prospects for them. So I think we see diversity within a disciplined and market focus as being the right answer, meaning that you need to have a big geographic footprint, because mining's an example. The mining's going to happen wherever the lowest cost production turns out to be. And if you're there, it's great. And if you're not, it's not so great. And you've got to have a robust market structure in that location to be able to afford to stay there when it's not happening. So that's what we're trying to build, is something where we can move resources around to be where the market is, and these four key and markets plus environment, which we're very enthused about as well. And that's what we'll be aiming for as we chart our growth path for the company. We've always said we want a greater portion of our revenues and services, so we'll be trying to get that done as well. We're pleased with how Kent's has impacted that, but we'd like more of that.
And is M&A still an important component of achieving your goals?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's pretty hard in this market to grow much more than low single digits organically. And so it does create an attractive M&A market. You know, we have to demonstrate we've got something that makes sense and that can be as financially as successful for us as Kent's. Kent's has had some tailwinds from the market, the investor market, because of the oil and gas business. But I can tell you, if we bought Kent's again today, we'd have to pay exactly the same amount because they're making all the numbers that we did the original deal on. So unless you're going to get a substantially lower EBITDA margin on the acquisition, it's the same valuation. So we're happy with that.
Okay. And maybe for Neil, just back on the opportunities in oil and gas in the Middle East, one of Kent's longtime clients on the E&C side feels pretty good about a new refinery project in Kuwait. You know, is this the type of work that they would look to bring Kent's in on, or is this something that's on your radar there?
Well, the new refinery in Kuwait is certainly something that interests us because we have experience there, we've got a presence there, we do have people within legacy SNC-Lavalin who have relationships with KOC and KNPC within that country. So that's only one of many prospects that are currently within our prospects list across the whole region. I mean, there are opportunities for us in Qatar that are within Saudi Arabia. There certainly is within Abu Dhabi. We are, you know, currently doing work for the NOCs within Abu Dhabi, and of course there's the work that we are also pursuing and some that we're executing for the IOCs with regards to work in Iraq. So there's opportunities right across the region for us to deploy our expertise, not just from a I think the addition is it's not just from a legacy Kent's perspective, it's from the new combined oil and gas capability perspective. And I think it's also around the fact that we have capabilities that we can ultimately cross-sell and deliver to clients across our four sectors. So a lot of what's going on in the Middle East also requires infrastructure, it requires power, it requires environmental water capabilities, pipeline capabilities, and we have all of that to deploy. And part of what we're trying to achieve with the new structure is for us to do that naturally as everyday business rather than trying to look at it as a pure cross-selling initiative. So we're not there yet, but certainly that's where we aim to rapidly get to.
Great. And last real quick one for me. Bob, can you just confirm on the buyback that you're in fact able to repurchase stock while in an active process to sell Highway 407?
Our lawyers tell us we're in an open position right now today. You know, the only thing we would worry about on that is we have to be in an open position when we renew our NCIB. We still have capacity left in our existing NCIB until that time. So at this point, we're reasonably confident we can actually execute the buyback from a regulatory perspective. That's what we're going to try to make happen.
Okay. Thanks for taking my questions.
Your next question comes from the line of Chris Murray of AltaCorp Capital. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Bob, you mentioned with the change in role for Neil that you'll be able to focus a little more on some of the issues. You know, there's been some comments attributed to you as of late that maybe you have maybe a different orientation on how you can deal with some of the issues that you're facing in terms of criminal charges. Can you give us some more idea about maybe what your thinking is there as we move forward?
Well, I think, you know, achieving the policy change that we think we need to get the issue resolved the way we want to do it is going to take a fair bit of elbow grease, I would say, and a lot of socialization. And so it's important. Part of doing the organization is important for me to have time to do that socialization, to bring constituents up to speed on what the implications are for both us and them in this process. So we have a well-designed process that we have a great team working on, and we've got a lot of good momentum going. I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but at this point, we feel confident that we have the window of opportunity. You know, it might take us 18 months or so, but to get this done.
Do you think there's a chance that you could come to some sort of resolution without having fully to go through a court process?
Oh, we don't intend to go through a full court process. It's possible we could end up there, but that's not what we're gearing up to do. We're gearing up to avoid the full court process.
Okay, great. And then just thinking about, you know, once you sort of have some sort of resolution, you know, once I guess you're in a more normalized situation where, you know, perhaps some contingent liabilities go away, what's the thought process right now? I mean, you've announced the NCIB, but at some point there's always been this discussion that, you know, there may be cash available. At that point, you know, what's the thinking behind the balance between return of capital to shareholders, either in the form of dividends or buybacks, and, you know, maybe restarting on a growth path in acquisitions?
We have a long-term model which suggests that we can achieve our what we believe we need to do in growth to stay tier one in a consolidating industry and return cash to shareholders through a buyback or some other mechanism. So at steady state, I can hardly wait to get there. We would expect to be playing in both M&A and a buyback or some other return of capital in that scenario.
Okay. But is any sort of participation in that conditional on getting to the sort of the end of the resolution with the different authorities?
Not necessarily, but you know, it just removes a whole lot of things we'd rather not think about to have that resolved. So we're trying to get resolved either way. But if we were right now today to be at our target EBITDA margin, and we had filled in what we think are the critical holes in our portfolio from an M&A perspective, we would be considering that now.
Okay, great. Thank you, General.
Your next question comes from the line of Benoit Poirier of Desjardins. Please go ahead.
Congrats for the recent contract award and also for your new role, Bruce. If we look at the latest contract, you've been quite successful with the Champlain Bridge, and it seems like you're very well positioned with Eglinton. You also mentioned that you want to be aggressive on the share buyback. So just with respect to M&A, should we assume that you prefer to digest those big announcements before moving on the M&A activity, Bob?
We don't see the big projects linked at all with M&A. We've, of course, been busy getting the Kent's acquisition integrated. We achieved that at the end of the year, and now we're in the phase of really taking advantage of synergies that Neil is leading. And so we're pleased with that. And we're active in the community thinking about M&A, but I'm not, you know, it's not top of mind right now. Our top priority right now is execution, which is, what Neil's focusing on, and dealing with liabilities, which is what I'm focusing on. But if we find a good M&A fit, we'll definitely take advantage of it, and we think we're well equipped financially to do so. Lempierre, did you want to add anything?
No, it's exactly that. We stabilize performance. We engage most of resources to deliver on cost in time our big projects. We take care of our shareholders considering their market opportunities, and we try to extract additional value from the market. So we'll be ready once the times will come to enter into an M&A, as Bob just described.
Yeah, but again, these big projects do not create a huge disruption in the company. It's normal stuff for us. They're only disruptive when they're not going well. Unfortunately, most of those are gone now. So.
Okay. And with respect to the remaining assets for ICI that you intend to monetize over time, you've been also successful in terms of valuation in the past. Should we assume a similar quality or valuation matrix for those assets going forward?
We see strong valuation in the marketplace. The only caveat I would get is you guys are always moving your target up. So, if we can stay ahead of your target, that's an ambitious goal, but, we feel good about valuation, so.
Okay. And mining and metallurgy, in terms of the EBIT margin, quite an achievement of almost 8% versus previous quarter versus last year. Is it something achievable in the coming quarters or anything non-recurring in the quarter?
Yeah, I think ultimately there was a couple of non-recurring pieces in there. So we are very pleased about where it is today, and the average over the year is likely to be slightly down, not slightly up.
Okay, perfect. And last one, just on the nuclear side, obviously very well positioned with respect to the refurbishment opportunities in Ontario. Am I right to say that it's been pushed back a little bit, Bob? Is it something that you're aware of?
Well, what you're saying is Bruce was discussing a year ago about doing refurbishment at the same time. Now it seems to be, it's up to them, but it appears to us to be moving into more of a sequential operation. Our work has gone really well at Darlington, on cost, on schedule, safe. I think the client's very happy with it. That's a deliberate program, and so it's not a hurry-up program, and there could be some delay there. Those are the kinds of things I worry about on the timing side, but we're very comfortable with the project.
Okay, thanks for the time, and congrats for the quarter.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Frederic Bastien of Raymond James. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Back to your plans to sell all Canadian ICIs, and I apologize if you've already touched on this, but is the idea to sell them as a package or individually?
I don't want to comment on that, but we've looked at all of those alternatives.
Okay. Next one, thanks for that. Next one relates to the changes you make to your reporting and also your decision specifically to fold environment and water into ICI. What was driving that? Is this your analysis of whether you can scale it up to where you want it to be, or if you could provide more color
on
that?
Well, environment was never intended to be reported. It became reported because there were three elements in the former REW. Two of them we report. So by default, you get the third one. And so what we've done is combined environment with infrastructure engineering, which is our other consulting business, so they're the same business model, and that just made sense from a management perspective at this time. We believe for environment to hit the point that we aspire to, you need several hundred million more of revenue, and that's going to have to come in acquisition space. So that will be on our list of things to consider in acquisition space.
Okay, I appreciate that. Lastly, Champlain Bridge, are you planning to build it out of steel or out of concrete?
I don't want to comment on that just yet.
Just thought I'd try. Thank you.
Yeah.
And your next question comes from the line of Maxim Sytchev of Dundee Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I was wondering, actually, if you don't mind providing an update in terms of the percentage of the problematic projects, in terms of, revenue, where you left with that bucket?
Maxim, I think, as we said in the last call, the revenue has really stopped becoming a surrogate for risk. So we continue to work that backlog off, but you know what we have now is almost all of those projects except St. Justine is in operation. But we still are concerned about warranty risk and other things that could happen. We think we have them in hand and we've properly reserved for them, but that lives with us for a bit. We were really happy with this quarter to not get any bad surprises from those, and we hope that Murphy stays in the closet and we have good luck in the next three. So I think, Denis, we could probably give the backlog number, but I wouldn't use it for anything at this point. It's mostly St. Justine.
It's mainly St. Justine, and obviously it's less than the previous quarter.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. No, that makes sense. And then actually kind of building on that topic and infrastructure in general, and you suggesting that infrastructure should be back in black in 2016, is this, I mean, obviously predicated on Champlain and potentially Eglinton, is there anything else that you have to win in order to be able to be positive on the EBIT side in 2016 from that division?
Well, there's a whole bunch of deal flow that occurs in infrastructure that you don't hear about, that's just every day. So if all of that dried up, that we'd be in trouble. And we have several more large projects that are in the pipeline now that could make a big difference for us. So I wouldn't want to say we don't need to win anything else, but those certainly, if we get business as usual with those and we're stay successful working off the bad backlog, then we should be in the black in 2016, and then we have our eyes on the deal flow that would be required that we would win between now and mid-2016 that would also then propel us with those into 2017 in the black.
Okay, no, that's
2017 more than in the black, 2016 in the black, and 2017 into some decent margins.
Okay. And then on the consolidated margin target of 6-8 on EBITDA, how do you think in terms of sort of hitting that range? How predicated is it on macro helping you over the next, let's call it 18 months, or do you think just based on better execution you should be able to maybe hit the low range on that target?
Well, I think the key is to not have markets going down. That makes it the hardest because you've got resource adjustments to do there. So if we get a flat market, we think we're well positioned enough to take a pretty good shot at it. It would be really handy to have a growing market because then we've demonstrated through Kent's that we can absorb a lot more. Even though we've been cutting SG&A at a good pace, we can absorb a lot more revenue within our SG&A. As you can see, we added no SG&A to take in Kent's. So if we get an uptick, then it's disproportionately beneficial to us.
Right. And then one last clarification, just in terms of the 4-7 timing, I just wanted to make sure that I heard correctly that you said that the official commencement of the process will be in Q4, or is that you're hoping to complete a transaction in Q4?
So, yeah, let me explain, because I'm sorry if there's been some confusion. So if you think of just the process, we've really been in the process here since we closed on Kent's. We've now announced we've hired advisors, so that's the next step. The next step is when we actually go out for tenders. So we would issue an official notice to the interested parties who might want to purchase the asset and say, here's the rules of engagement, and you've got to turn in something by this date. That will be a formal press release. You'll see that, probably. We don't have to, but on AltaLink, that's what you saw in November of 2013, I believe, is when that went out. You'll see something like that, and that will fire the gun of the official process. That's what we're saying will be done by the end of this year. Could be earlier, but that's the commitment we're making. Then once we do that, there's a whole array of timing, you know. So we could sell it to one of our partners nearly overnight. We're not sure that's best value to go through that process at the get-go. And it could take as long as a year depending on what rights are exercised and what steps we think we need to be taken to maximize our value. And so once we start the process, we're going to be gauging how best to maximize value. And because, you know, there's not a screaming need for the cash right now, we will probably take all the steps necessary to deliver full value. So that would be, say, 6 to 12 months nominally from when we start that official part of the process. Does that help you?
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. And I guess I'm sorry, in terms of, do you feel that there has been a bit of slippage in terms of timing, or do you feel sort of the process rolls as you had originally anticipated?
Well, I apologize if I've miscommunicated, but when I've said this year, I've always meant the official start of the process. So we realize some people took that differently, and so that's why we're trying to be clear now that what we're talking about is a press release comes out saying we are now into the formal part of the process, and from there, although we could turn back, in our view, there's really no turning back from that point. So that's our commitment.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much.
That concludes today's question and answer session. Mr. Jasmin, at this time, I will turn the conference back to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you all for having joined us today. If you have any further questions, please do not hesitate to contact me. Have a good afternoon. Good night. Bye now.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect your lines.